Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, Head of Outreach and Governance.
And I'm Guntram Wolf, I'm the Director of Bruegel.
And we have the honor to host Dr. Vivian Balakrishnan, Minister for Foreign Affairs of Singapore. Minister Balakrishnan is also a medical doctor and the minister in charge of the Smart Nation Initiative. Welcome to The Sound of Economics, Minister.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Minister. We are very grateful for your availability to be with us and the possibility to learn more about how Singapore has been tackling the COVID-19 crisis, but also more broadly, learn about the economic impact in Singapore and the regional and global economic consequences of the current situation. But first things first, could you please start by giving our listeners an overview about the situation in Singapore for the COVID-19 pandemics and what have been the action taken by the government?
Well, this has been the most consequential crisis of our generation. You know, Singapore is a tiny city state. Our trade volume is 3.5 times our GDP. So we depend on free trade. We function as a hub for people, finance, ideas. So to be confronted by this once in a generation crisis, which has affected the whole world. So this is unlike SARS 17 years ago. This is not an infection only in East Asia. This is an infection globally. Second point is that it has occurred in very quick succession across the entire globe, and therefore has led to simultaneous lockdowns, shutdowns, or various forms of restrictions, which have had a very heavy economic impact, both on the supply and on the demand side, and obviously including on trade. So I think the point I want to emphasize here is that this global crisis occurring simultaneously has had profound impact on a tiny city-state like ours, which depends on connectivity, on flow of people, flow of finance. And we function best when the world is stable and everything is running well. So it has been a challenge. Second point I would make is that we were also one of the early countries to be affected beyond China, because you know we have very strong dynamic relations with China, particularly on the economic front and in terms of tourism as well. So by late January, we already had our first case. So that's the second point. If you look at what's happened over the past 4 months, so in the first wave, it was basically imports due from tourism, which in turn set off a small secondary clusters locally, which have been settled. Then there was a second wave in February, March, when we basically had about 500 to 600 cases, imported cases. These were our own people returning home from the rest of the world who were seeking safe refuge. And you know, in this time and age, citizenship must have its privileges. And obviously, we had to take our people back. And some of these thousands who came back, 500 to 600 of them were infected with COVID virus. So we had to deal with imported cases. Well, this also has been settled. Today, the number of imported cases will run at about zero. The big challenge, which I would say we have been dealing with over the past 6 weeks, and which I'm reasonably confident we are plateauing, is on the situation with our migrant workers in dormitories. For this, I would take reference from what the WHO described. The WHO said, well, migrant worker dormitories were like ships on land. And it's, I think, an apt analogy. If you think about what happened, the Diamond Princess, a luxury cruise liner with 6-star accommodation. Often if you think of the aircraft carrier, Theodore Roosevelt, which is a military installation with thousands of people. So I think if you follow the WHO analogy of ships on land, what we have learned is that this virus is far more contagious than anticipated initially. And when you have people living in close quarters, interacting socially, and at workplaces intensively, this virus thrives very well in such a milieu. So this is what we've been dealing with, the situation in our migrant worker dormitories, but I'm confident that this will also be resolved in due time. So that's where we're at. For the last 6 weeks, we've had what we call a circuit breaker, which is a variant of a lockdown. It's a gentler form of a lockdown. And what that has done is to bring the numbers all the way down. In terms of local transmission, I think today we had perhaps one citizen who got infected. Even for foreigners who are working and living in our community, the cases are practically single digits. We still have cases in the dormitories, but that's really a function of testing, because I think we are doing very aggressive testing. The vast majority of them are not showing any symptoms. But in our own Singaporean way, I was tempted to say German way, where we test them very methodically and aggressively, we will still continue to show positive cases. But overall, I'm confident of where we're at. But let's not underestimate this virus. Mm. It's turned out to be a far more potent threat to health, to the economy, even to society and politics. I don't think we will get back to status quo ante anytime soon. In fact, there will be a new normal, and we will all have to learn to live with the implications of this new normal, both on the economic front and on the social front.
Well, thank you very much, Minister. Perhaps we can spend a bit more time on the Singapore experience itself and just ask you a few follow-up questions on the specific policy response that you took in Singapore. And I think one of the starting points also at the time when we initially approached the Singaporean government to interact with you was the success of your early strategy, especially the success of the tracking apps, so the success of technology in actually containing the virus. Now you have described that this has become much more complicated for migrant workers that live in very closed dormitories with little access to bathrooms and so on. But I mean, can you describe a bit more the initial phase of the reaction and especially the use of technology in containing the virus? And do you think that this kind of technology can be actually scaled globally and can be used to really contain the virus globally? Or is that not a strategy that can be used globally because the globe just operates differently from a city state like Singapore?
Well, thank you for that set of, in fact, it's a series of very profound questions on different themes. I think the first point I want to emphasize is the need for preparation. In the case of Singapore, we had a tough time 17 years ago with SARS. And ever since then, we've been preparing for the next pandemic. We have now a National Center of Infectious Diseases. We had built up our ICU capacity. We had built up the number of isolation capacities. And therefore, when this occurred, we were confident that at least on the healthcare front, the doctors, the nurses, the laboratories, the professionals, the isolation facilities, the intensive care facilities, the number of ventilators, we were prepared. I think if any country does not start with that initial advantage, you are facing a very grave challenge. So that's the first point. Facilities, professionals, we were ready. The next point I would make is that it's very important to be on the lookout, to anticipate problems, and to take early action. So, for instance, we were one of the first to impose travel restrictions. Our trading partners, our tourist sources were not happy with us. But we had to explain that we had a responsibility both to our own local population as well as to the millions of people who transit through Singapore to keep Singapore safe. So that is not really so much a healthcare call as a political call, which means to keep a lookout and be prepared to take early, decisive action. Similarly, when China published the genome of this virus, and they did so, in fact, in early January, our labs immediately began to work on PCR primers as well as antibody tests. And those have turned out to be very useful. So the point here, again, is being prepared and being able to act quickly to get testing and other scientific and laboratory facilities ready very early on. A related sub-point there, if you think back to late January and even early to middle February, this was the time when even China was really snowed under, inundated with cases. And even back then, the fact that we were prepared and that we were able to, in our own small way, even help with supplies of tests and PPE to China at the point of greatest need. And obviously, if you fast forward to today, now that they have overcome their problems and their manufacturing is back to full steam or almost full steam as far as healthcare is concerned, they in turn have now been able to supply us the necessary equipment, tests, and so on. So the point here I'm trying to make is that being prepared and being prepared to help others at their point of greatest need. And then in due time and circumstances change, and that is reciprocated. It's actually a point about interdependence and collaboration and cooperation. And that, I think, is a point worth making in the midst of this crisis, when many countries have been tempted to just turn inwards, deal with their own problems, and not pay attention to what's happening around and externally. Because, in fact, the reason why we feel this is important is precisely because this is a global problem. And none of us are going to be out of danger unless every country and every community is equally safe. So there is a need for us to maintain this commitment to multilateralism and globalization in the fullest sense of the word. It's not just empty talk, but actually acting on that basis. So that we found was crucial and defined our early reaction to it. Then if you turn your mind to the nuts and bolts of it, what does it really mean when we talk about dealing with the problem domestically? Number one, I already alluded to the fact that we had sufficient facilities and wonderful healthcare professionals. That is the reason why our mortality rates, in fact, are so low. I think today we have had 22 fatalities. The denominator of cases detected is more than 28,000. So you can see in terms of case fatality rate, it is one of the lowest in the world. Again, that reflects the quality of healthcare and facilities. And in particular, the point is that we were never overwhelmed. Our healthcare facilities were never overwhelmed. If you think about Europe, Europe has good and excellent healthcare facilities. And I speak from personal experience, having interacted with the professionals in Europe. But you will see that in parts of Europe, you've had, in some places, rather high mortality rates. It's not because of any failure on the part of healthcare professionals. It's because healthcare systems were overwhelmed by the rapid number of cases that presented to their doorstep. So we have been able to avoid that. Related to this point of being able to treat and to ensure that your system doesn't get overwhelmed, the other critical ingredient which we had the advantage was contact tracing and the ability to isolate people quickly and effectively so that they did not pose a threat of onward transmission. If you look at this virus so far, in fact, you will see that most infections occur at home at the workplace, or where there is where there is active social interaction, places of worship, singing, karaoke, meals, shared meals. That's where the role of contact tracing becomes absolutely crucial. And to make things more complicated, we subsequently discovered that this virus was different from SARS in the sense that people were contagious even before they showed symptoms, even if they had very mild upper respiratory tract symptoms. Whereas in the case of SARS, most infections occurred in hospitals for people who had pneumonia. Again, what this meant was that the reason COVID-19 was so much harder to control is because it needed early, urgent, quick interventions. And here I want to make one point, because I know you've asked about technology, is that in fact, I believe you cannot remove humans from the center of the equation. And that, let me try to explain why. First, you need a human being to exercise judgment. Which interactions, which venues, which activities place the person at risk, either of getting the infection or in turn infecting others? Second, and this is maybe I'm biased because I'm a doctor, is that I believe when someone is diagnosed with a condition, you want a human being to inform you. Your test is positive. What does it mean? What do you need to do? What precautions you need to take? What is the danger to your family? I don't believe this kind of human counseling, this human encounter, can be outsourced to a machine or to an algorithm or to a smart app on a phone. So that's a key point. The human remains in the center of the system. Now, having said that, the purpose of technology is to facilitate that very human-centric work. So in our case, we were, I think, one of the first in the world to use Bluetooth proximity data to facilitate the human identification of close contacts. Now, when we came up with this, we were immediately confronted with several policy and, in a sense, political choices. The key is privacy. And this one point which I want to emphasize is that a lot of the debate out there now on contact tracing apps is bifurcated into two groups. The so-called centralized system, where Big Brother knows everything, or decentralized system, where it's anonymous, decentralized, and you're depending on an algorithm to inform you, and then you're depending on people exercising judgment as to what they need to do about it. In the case of Singapore, we very deliberately decided that we would not take either extreme. And let me explain how our system works. When we created an app, we call it Trace Together, and we open sourced the protocol called Blue Trace. We open sourced it because we wanted people to be able to check and understand the system, but the real key thing was to build up trust that this was not a nefarious Big Brother surveillance operation. So we've maintained that commitment to open source and open standards. Second, we have made sure that all the data that is captured by the app resides in your own device, in your own phone. If you are never infected with COVID-19, or if you have never become a close contact or a person at risk of being infected or infecting others, that data would never leave your phone. And that data would also be erased after 14 days. So my point is, don't get trapped in two extremes. We can create a system based on open source and open standards, which collects data, which is protected, encrypted, and private. But if you are diagnosed, a human being will call you up, explain the implications, will invite you with consent to to upload that data in order to facilitate human contact tracing. So that's the model we are at. And I just wanted to make those, you know, to reemphasize those two points. You cannot remove the human from the center, and you must continue to protect privacy and build trust. And if we can do that, then and only then can we scale up contact tracing. You see, contact tracing, actually, if you look at it, the way it's practiced today, 50 years ago, it was pretty much the same. You know, it has not, the methodology has not really changed. The purpose of technology is just to make that process faster and scalable so that we can deal with a pandemic on the scale that we are currently confronting. So sorry to belabor that point, but I wanted to put technology in its own in its place.
I'm personally very interested about the use of technology and a human-centric approach that that you just discussed. And somehow the fact that this has been happening in Singapore in this kind of formula is also because, I mean, you are responsible for the Smart Nation initiative. So I suppose that all this has not been happening in a vacuum, in the sense that you might have already starting some infrastructure in terms of how you use technology in governmental initiatives. Beside other things that we've been seeing on TV, like we've been seeing the use of robot dogs or other kind of devices, which made look the images from Singapore very close to a science fiction movie, comparing to other parts of the world. So the question is, I mean, more than a question, is more like a reflection about how this was possible within the frame of a wider strategy that you have about the use of technology, and you know, and how this this pandemic, I mean, to a certain extent, has been accelerating your initiative for a Smart Nation.
I think you're referring to Spot, this robot that we have. You know, we didn't choose it because it looks like a dog. Let me explain. We wanted a remotely controlled robotic platform, which would be able to climb up steps, to climb down slopes, to cross water. And we quickly discovered that, in fact, a wheeled vehicle was not ideal. It needed legs. And four legs makes it more stable than two legs. It just happened then, incidentally, to look somewhat like a dog and walk something like a dog. But that was not intentional. There were actually more prosaic functional reasons for it. Second point I want to make is that even in the case of Spot, you'll notice I said remote control. There is a human operator. It's just that the human operator is not at that site itself. He's in a remote location, but that human operator can talk to the person that this robot happens to meet, and there is still human interaction. The next point I wanted to make, we were also very careful. We needed this robot to help us with social distancing and to ensure that there were no emergencies or risks from overcrowding at parks. So it needed to be able to sense and to count the number of human beings. But we did not want it to be able to identify human beings. And we had to make sure that that was in place. And we have also informed people of the limitations of the technology. The point which I'm trying to drive at, actually, again, is that all this does not occur in a vacuum. You need a society that understands what is going on, that appreciates the reasons why we are doing something, and has sufficient trust that the operators have the goodwill and the longer-term interests of society at heart. And that's why we've been able to do what we do, paying attention all the time to public trust and protection of privacy. I think that's absolutely crucial. And, you know, again, it just gives me an opportunity to reiterate the point. It's not technology for its own sake. It must be human-centric. It must be based on human values and optimized for human welfare. That's the way to do it.
Well, I mean, thank you very much for this further elaboration. And the robot dog is indeed a very, very good thing for television. And I think it apparently also worked very nicely in limiting excessive social contacts. We should perhaps move on from the technology side, even though I find it a fascinating debate myself. And I would love to discuss further the technology issues, including all these questions around the capability of these kind of apps to be scaled globally. Because, I mean, we have now a model in Singapore and, you know, in the European Union. Every country is sort of working on its own version of an app. The uptake is not very big in European countries, and so in a sense we lose out on the capacity to have these models actually and these apps to work together, in which is essentially what you need in a globalized world. So I think, but okay, perhaps you might want to add a word on this. Perhaps a very quick word on this, and then I really want to move on to the question that you raised and the point that you made very initially, which is the impact on the global economic system of the virus and the fact that it lasts so long. I think it would be fantastic to hear on this afterwards. But perhaps one word on just the scalability of the apps globally.
Well, I think everybody is devising their own systems. My own view is that if everyone committed to open source and sharing those platforms, and in particular making sure our platforms are interoperable whilst respecting our domestic political priorities on protecting people's privacy and making sure that everything we do rests on a foundation of public trust, I think if we can do that effectively together, it will be crucial. And the reason why it'll be crucial is this. When we overcome the initial phase of the disruption caused by COVID-19, we are going to have to reopen. We are going to have to be able to resume travel, to resume trade, to rebuild those supply chains. And without respect for each other's domestic standards and priorities, without interoperability of our systems, our technological solutions, it will make it much harder for us to rebuild those supply chains, those green lanes for the resumption of travel, and for all the other things that keep the global economy going. So in a sense, it segues quite nicely into your next question,
yes,
which is where we see the global economy. My first point is that we are deeply worried. This is, you know, in our lifetime, certainly for the three of us here, I don't think we've ever faced a crisis on this scale simultaneously occurring in all countries, and for which even in the most optimistic scenario, that is an effective vaccine becoming available. We are still talking about at least a year or perhaps even longer. And in fact, it may be wishful thinking that we will get back to life as normal, status quo ante. In fact, it is more likely that we're going to have to deal with a new normal. So that's the first point, right? All of us simultaneously affected. And it has damaged both supply and demand. And of course, all our central banks, all our ministries of finance have opened up all the taps to ensure that there's a lot of liquidity. But even then, I don't think any of us can conclude that there is no risk of this crisis morphing into a financial crisis as well. So it's not just the rail factories and the rail world, the supply and demand being affected, but even on the finance front. And all this opening of taps, fiscal taps and monetary taps, at some point, they will have to be withdrawn. At some point, the debts will have to be paid. And that's not going to be easy. In the case of Singapore, we are very fortunate because we've got big reserves. And all the measures that we've rolled out now, all the fiscal support that we're extending to our population, we're depending on current reserves as well as beginning to tap on past reserves. But we can do everything now without taking on new debt, without passing the burden of debt servicing to our children and grandchildren. But there are very, very few governments with this blessing. We are fortunate to have that. But nevertheless, if there is a global economic and financial crisis occurring at the same time, we will be severely affected because, as I said earlier, trade is 3.5 times our GDP. The next element that we're concerned with, worried about, is the relationship between China and the United States. It is a complex and complicated thing in which both politics and economics combine to create a very difficult situation. If the two superpowers cannot effectively collaborate, then there are many global problems that will be well nigh impossible to solve. Global problems like climate change, pandemics, in fact, is just another example of a global problem that will require global leadership and global collaboration. And right now, if you listen to the rhetoric on both sides, it's a source of deep anxiety for the rest of us, including, I'm sure, for those of you in Europe. And then you have the problem of supply chains being bifurcated. Now, I think the one lesson which we've all taken from this is that you cannot, in the name of efficiency, depend on just-in-time and assume that everything will work in peacetime as well as in a crisis. So yes, I think all of us will have to pay more attention to paying the premium for insurance for resilience. As I said, stockpiles, preparation, critical resources, the ability to either manufacture or to diversify your sources. So all this will have a profound impact on the global supply chains that we have witnessed developing over the past 2 or 3 decades. How and where this evolution will go, we'll have to watch very closely. And certainly in the case of us in Singapore and so a place like in Europe or especially for Germany, you'll want to pay attention to this. Another related source of economic concern is commodity prices. And although Singapore does not have any hydrocarbon resources, but nevertheless, we have companies that are world-class producers of jack-up rigs, exploratory equipment, and a collapse or great volatility in commodity prices also affects our economy. And then if you still want to go with me to extend the list, think about tourism, entertainment, culture, services, airlines, ports, airports. All those are decimated right now. How quickly will they rebound? It's an open question. So if you look, you know, if you're a pessimist, there's no shortage of candidates to line up. But one final point I'll make before I'll take it and ask you for another question is I completely agree with Richard Haass, the president of the Council for Foreign Relations, that this crisis has accelerated history rather than reshaped history. And I agree with him because if you think about it, even before this crisis erupted, there were already strains in the relationship between the two superpowers. There was already pushback against globalization. There were already profound questions about global supply chains and their resilience. There were already questions about the future of jobs. And there were questions about the role of digital technologies and artificial intelligence, surveillance, and so on and so forth. So in a sense, what this crisis has caused us is to in fact accelerate our search for solutions to these fundamental challenges, these fundamental strategic challenges that in fact have been confronting us for the past few years. It's not new, but now we do not have the luxury of time. We need to work quickly. We need to resolve how we're going to do it domestically and then how to interoperate and operate globalization with a new normal. So we have our hands full in the months and years to come.
I might still want to ask one question from one of our listeners, Jan von Herf, who is asking if you could elaborate on the role of Singapore in the regional response in the context of ASEAN.
Thank you. Well, at several levels. First, our leaders of the 10 countries have been in touch. Well, obviously not directly in touch, but through video conferences and summits, phone calls. There has been meetings convened both within ASEAN as well as ASEAN plus China, Japan, and Korea. Including, we had one session with the EU. Joseph Borrell's hosted a session for all the ASEAN foreign ministries as well. So at the level of information exchange, that has been occurring. Beyond that, at the level of mutual assistance, so for instance, test kits, PPEs, sharing of information, scientific and medical information, and providing emergency equipment, that has quietly been happening below the radar screen without too much publicity, but enough to remind each other that we are interdependent. And the only way we're going to emerge from this crisis is collectively as an entire region. In a way, it's a very similar challenge to what the EU faces. That you can't just solve your own problems, you also have to look to your neighbors and to make sure that they don't run into too much trouble either. The third thing which we are doing is also studying how we will emerge from this crisis and how that we can facilitate that emergence by working together. And again, I want to emphasize this theme of interoperability of our systems, trust in each other's testing and healthcare facilities, and making sure that there is mutual confidence and mutual support. So this is happening, but it's still a long way more to go because this crisis is nowhere near the end. I think at the best, we are near the end of the beginning of this crisis. So rest assured, we know that we are all vulnerable and we will have to work together.
So perhaps, Minister, thank you so much for talking about the regional aspect. But let me perhaps ask one question from one of our listeners, which is specific on Singapore again, and which I think is quite interesting in the sense that Singapore is, of course, a hub. It's a hub for trade, it's a hub for finance, it's a hub for people exchange, it's a hub for education also. So it is really an important hub. And of course, as a hub, as you laid down at the beginning, you're particularly vulnerable to and particularly affected by all these disruptions to global trade, to global collaboration that we are currently seeing. So if you could just say from the point of view of Singapore and what you can do within Singapore, what do you see as the biggest hurdles that need to be overcome for Singapore to continue being an attractive hub for companies post-pandemic? That's a question asked by Raphael Fabian.
Yes, no, that's an excellent question. I think the most important thing is how you behave during a crisis. Whether you are open, whether you're trustworthy, whether you're reliable, whether you come through during a crisis. So let me give you an example dealing specifically with our hub status. When this crisis was erupting, there were many Europeans marooned in different parts of the world. Obviously, many in Asia, but even some beyond Asia. And you know that, in fact, right now, most airlines, most air services, most airports are closed. If you go to an airport now, like it's likely to be empty. But there were thousands of Europeans who needed and wanted to go home. And South Americans, North Americans, and other parts of Asia. Because we are a hub, in fact, Singapore was a key node, a key air bridge for all these repatriations. But at the same time, we also had to make sure that this could be done safely and it did not become an amplification point for virus. So this is something which we worked very closely and effectively with the European Union. And you speak to the people in Brussels, they will tell you, I mean, we quietly but effectively did this. Why we do this? First, on humanitarian reasons. People have needs, and if we can help, we should help. Second, if during the depths of a crisis, you realize who came through and who was reliable, who remained open, and at the same time, open in a responsible way. Investors making future decisions will remember that. So we've continued to quietly, effectively, and safely fulfill our role as a hub, both for goods, for people needing to return home, and of course, for the supply, the flow of essential medical supplies. And here again is another, you know, you would say perhaps unintended consequence of being small and being reliable. People know we will not impound supplies flowing through Singapore. If we need anything, we would purchase it at market rates. We would fulfill our contracts. We would not declare and take precipitate action and withhold the free flow of goods, and especially of essential medical supplies. The point I'm making is that this reputation for probity, reliability, respect for the sanctity of contract is very important. And we do so now, but I'm sure, you know, after this crisis is over, I think people will remember.
I think this last point, if investors indeed see what you just describe, it might just be another element of the acceleration of trends that we've seen before before the pandemic that Richard Haas was describing, as some investments might actually move away from some of the traditional hubs such as New York to Singapore. And so this will be certainly one of the interesting things to watch. And is certainly one of the big geopolitical trends that I think has been is being accelerated by this pandemic. I think Giuseppe, we could go on forever, but I think Minister, you've been very generous with your time, and you have really made a very clear exposition of what is the thinking of Singapore on these issues. I'm sure many points will be seen differently by some of our listeners. So this is great to have the debate and to hear from you, really your point of view. And I think it was really a very, very interesting presentation. And I would like to very much thank you for your availability this morning or this afternoon in Singaporean time,
yes,
and your frankness in your responses. So thank you so much, Minister, for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you Also from my side, Minister.
Look forward to meeting you all in person and shaking real hands.
I would like to remind you, as usual, that you can find all the analysis of our scholars on the coronavirus crisis and beyond on our website, www.bruegel.org. Until next time, bye-bye.